Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the New Books in Anthropology, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Bhumika, the host for today. And today we're going to talk to Dr. Siddharthan Monaguru about his new book, Marrying for a Future, Transnational Sri Lankan Tamil Marriages in the Shadow of War, which was published this year by the University of Washington Press in their Global South Asia series. Dr. Siddharthan Monaguru is an assistant professor of the South Asian Studies Program at the National University of Singapore. Thank you so much for joining us today, Siddharthan. We're so happy and lucky and glad to have you.
Thank you, Bhumika. Thank you so much for inviting me to be part of New Books Network. And I am very happy and glad to be here. And it's a great pleasure to be here and to have this conversation on my book. Thank you.
Excellent. Thank you so much. So let me begin right away by requesting you to tell us a little about your arrival to anthropology, your journey to anthropology, and sort of your pursuit of anthropology now as a matter of scholarly interest, as a matter of career. So if you could tell our listeners, I'm sure I'm very keen to know about the way not just this book came about, but how you came about anthropology as well.
Sure. It's an interesting story how I came to anthropology. And anthropologists are great storytellers, so I have story to tell. For my undergrad, I did sociology, but I always interested in anthropology. But as you know, in South Asian countries, you don't have separate anthropology department per se at the time. So anthropology always taught within sociology. But also you learn sociology more or less. Professor Garanath Obeysagra came to Sri Lanka and he was giving talk. And then I was really interested in his work and so on and so forth for a long time. And you know, Garanath is known for his work on Sri Lanka and beyond. So after undergrads, I was an undergraduate student at that time. I was finishing and I was going to listen to his talk. And after the talk, I want to meet him, but I could not meet him because he's very famous. Everybody's around him. So I had to wait in the corner to meet him, but I could not meet him for a long time because everybody was surrounded by a lot of people. So at the end of the meeting, then he sort of took a break and went out. So I ran behind him. I think he must be going to the bathroom, I suppose. But I ran behind him and sort of caught him at the moment before he go to the bathroom and said, "I am so and so. I am interested in your work." So he laughed and he said, "Why you could not come and meet me there?" I said, "You were surrounded by a lot of people." So then he said, he gave me his card and said, "Come home." He went to his home. Eventually, I developed a great relationship with him, and I tend to do some work for him. And I think his influence in my life actually led me to do anthropology. At one point, after a year or 2 years, he said, "You should go and do anthropology." And that's how I arrived to anthropology, actually, through Garanath. And then he directed me to people that I should work with and so on and so forth. I ended up in Johns Hopkins. And so then start working with Vuna and Navida Khan, Professor Navida Khan, where I actually developed the idea of anthropology. I think they shaped, both of them had a huge influence in the way in which I think about anthropology. I think about the way in which the anthropology now, and it has a lot of influence in my work. And my peers from Johns Hopkins. So basically, my journey to anthropology starts after my undergrad. So that's how I came to anthropology.
Fantastic. What a lovely story that is. I'm sure everybody who's listening is equally charmed, impelled, compelled, motivated, inspired by Gandharatha Bisekri's writing, one of the finest we have from not just the subcontinent, but I would say just canonically and intellectually everywhere. So that is a great story indeed. You know, in that spirit, I also wanted to invite you to tell us about the conceptualization of this book. You know, it is an unusual study of conflict and political violence because it gets to those stark concerns and questions by the way of what you call the in-betweenness that occurs for those who live with it intimately, even if they are removed from it sort of physically. In a way that you tell us a story up through very, very mobile social fields, as you call it in your own work, so that such that, you know, the choice of how the story is told and from where it is told is not only a matter of multi-sitedness for the sake of it, but is it, it's the way in which it unravels. So I wanted you to, you know, speak to us about both the ethics of this kind of mobile social field work and the kinds of personal intellectual impulses that you had in the conceiving of such a methodology, because the book does exactly that so well. So if you could tell us, tell our listeners about how you came about conceptualizing this book as such. How did it come to you to study violence and conflict through a study of transnational marriages? That would be lovely.
Yeah, thank you. So this war, the book is about transnational marriages in the time of war. So as you know, the war has ended in 2009, 10 years ago, but my study took place in the time of war. And I also grew up in Sri Lanka in the time of war. So for me, it's always a question, a larger question that I was interested all the time, even when I was in Sri Lanka or when I was doing these studies, is how people live with hope or imagine future or better life in the time of prolonged war. And despite of suffering, fear, despair, and loss, that has become a part of their everyday life. So how do they imagine futures and live that future? And how do they learn to live with the idea of uncertainty? So that was the biggest thing for me, because even in my own experience of living in the time of war, in Jaffna, in a war zone, where we constantly used to roam around, we go to schools, we do things, we went to classes, we bicycled around the roads while there were violence taking place. People were killed, people were disappeared, people were jailed, and so on and so forth. So we don't know whether we will live the next day, but we continue to do so. So for me, this whole question about how we learn to live with this uncertainty, but still there's a life even within the time of violence. So that's always a question for me, how to say that, how to talk about that. And the second question is also about the mass migration, and constantly people were displaced, not only to outside Sri Lanka, but also within Sri Lanka. People are constantly displaced to different part of the places. And this displacement and mass migration resulted from the war also created all sort of uncertainty. in people's life, that means that you don't know whether who will go first, who can bring whom, or the question about if two people get married, how do they travel, how long it will take, when will they start families, and so on and so forth. So these two things, due to war and mass migration, this idea of uncertainty has become an important thing to think about. So I want to tackle this idea of uncertainty, idea of how people learning to live in the time of uncertainty. And uncertainty is not a new thing. It's not only for war. It's an everyday thing. Even it's there in our everyday life. But in the time of war and mass migration, somehow it has come to the surface and very vividly. So how to think about that? So for me, one way of thinking through about the idea of uncertainty, idea of how to live with uncertainty, how people imagine a certain kind of futures, even at the time of chaos and uncertainty moments, it's a way to rethink about the idea of marriage. For me, even in the classical understanding of the anthropological study of marriage, there's always something to do with future. Even though people talked not in terms of future, but in 60s and 50s, where people talked about anthropology of kinship and marriage in terms of social reproduction. So the social reproduction is also an idea of a future. And also people talked about movement within marriage in terms of how people move from patrilocal residence to matrilocal residence, right? How people moved within, after the marriage, how a bride or a groom moved from one household to the other household. So there's always movement and mobility, ideas of futures attached to the marriage, but they never talked in terms of these languages. So I thought this is one way to think about. So if we start to think about marriage and especially transnational marriages through the idea of future and uncertainty, how do we then try to conceptualize not only about marriage, but also to think about the idea of uncertainty through the idea of marriage? So in that process, where I came to think about marriage as a way of thinking about the idea of uncertainty, idea about future, the idea about hope, and idea about potential or possibilities. So in that process, I also, when I start working on this, I also realize the time that takes from arranging a marriage to the time where the couples reunite across borders into a new country, because after the marriage take place between a person from Canada, a Sri Lankan Tamil from Canada, and a Sri Lankan Tamil from Sri Lanka getting married, and the Sri Lankan Tamil from Sri Lanka, a bride or a groom, ending up in Canada, takes sometimes 6 months, sometimes at that time, right, during the war, it takes from 6 months to 2 years and so on and so forth. So in that whole process, it takes such a long time. So I was interested in this process. So when I started looking at the process, there were so many actors and so many people, not only refugees or migrants, but also people who are non-migrant citizens and different kind of figures and documents and number of things sort of assembled together in this process over a long time, and it's constantly changing and moving. So when I looked at this process as it moves, as it goes on, and how people sort of navigate, live with it, and relive with it, and to make a sense of that whole process over a long period, I thought this is an interesting place to think about how the really people learn to live with uncertainty. And how people constantly making and remaking the idea of future, and also this process also make and unmake and remake relatednesses, because it has the power to create people, bring people and family together at the marriage broker's places. But at the same time, if the visa officer is not going to give a visa, then that can unmake that relationships, for example, and then uncertainty will begin, and they have to go to the immigration courts to fight over that, which might remake again if the judge give the visa back to the couples. So in this whole process, I looked at the idea of how this process take place become a very interesting place to think about, rethink about the larger question about uncertainty and ideas of futures, how people live and imagine a future. In that sense, I want to sort of, when I start thinking marriage as a process rather than as an institution or rather than as a structure, but more as a process, allowed me to think it in a different way. In that sense, I also term this in between as, I term the marriage process as in between. And the idea of in between emerges for me. It also specifically, because a lot of people works on diaspora, a lot of works on many other works I've already talked about in between, but also they talked about in between in different forms. Homi Bhabha talked about in between in terms of hybridity, Victor Turner's idea about in between as liminality, and so on and so forth. But for me, I sort of used Deleuze's idea of potential to bring to the idea of in between. As a potential is something about, it has the possibility of becoming something, but until it actualized, we don't know what it's going to be. But every time it actualizes, it can actualize differently. And potential for Deleuze, it's both actualized and yet to be actualized things. So it's both, there is a certain kind of possibilities, but also there is unknown factor also attached to the idea of potential. So I thought this whole process, for me, the way people constantly working and reliving and learning to live uncertainty is sent off in being in this potential moment. And they don't know what the outcome going to be, but if everything is actualized, they constantly go back and do something else. So the moment it actualized, things become a potential for their life to do something else. So that constant movement between potential and actual allows me to think about marriage process differently. So that's what I termed it in between, but in a very sort of a Deleuzian understanding of in between. And to take that and to think about how things get assembled in this in-between. So for me, here the in-between works differently. It's not only just a space or a figure, but it is also documents. It can be a temporary places. It can be a space or a zone. So it can be many things. And this in-between can be between, let's say if you take a marriage broker or a wedding photographer, there can be a figure that can be there in between two families who sort of, join these two families. They can be in between figures, or they can be an assemblage, the figures, the photographs, or the visa officers, documents, everything like an assemblage come together in this in-between process, the marriage process. So they can both be an in-between and also can be an assemblage of in the in-between process. So it has this flexibility of moving between these two or three or multiple ways. So that's how I thought the in-between is more, It's the multiplicity of the in-betweenness that I use in my work to think about how different figures, documents, places, quote spaces and other kind of zones come together and assemble and produce a particular affect and power and make and remake relateness. But that moment can change in the next assemblage. In the next assembly, different kind of things being produced. So this constantly, every time it assembles, it produces a particular future. But in the other, in the next assembly, it will produce a different kind of future. But this every moment producing that future create a certain kind of hope, certain kind of possibility of living, certain kind of possibility of thinking about future, in which people rebuild their life. And that moments are important for me. So that moments, even of small, how temporary it is, that moments in that in-betweenness make them to relive their life or reimagine their life.
That is fantastic. What a wonderful way of sort of, resonating the kinds of hope and distraction as well as possibilities and potential that people intimately live with in the both the times of war and, as your book says, in the shadows of war. So thank you so much for sharing that with us. You know, you were speaking about imagining or understanding marriage not merely as an institution but as a process. And in the book, does such a great job of evoking that again and again and again. In a way, you start looking at marriage as not even an event, but the way in which people make that event happen in the first place, and the kinds of choices that people are constantly making and thinking about in the contracting of those kinds of relationships. And given that fact that that is so central to how you talk to us about uncertainty, the in-betweenness, the potential of these kinds of choices that people are sometimes compelled to make because of the kind of political violence that is ongoing, I also wanted to invite you to speak about the ways in which you think your own understanding of marriage depart from the ways in which, you know, the quintessential literature on kinship and marriage does, and in the way you already begin speaking to it, and particularly in the ways in which you propose in your book. And I'm going to read a little sort of, you know, a little bit from the book on page 73, where you say that the notion of arranged marriage should be rethought in the anthropological literature. The dual notions of love and arranged marriage may lead to the misconception that an arranged marriage is less invested with romance and personal choice than socioeconomic and political strategies. However, boundaries seem blurred between an arranged and a love marriage in the case of transnational arranged unions among Jaffna Tamils. That is such a wonderful proposition to invite people who are thinking about marriage and romance and gender and intimacy and love in all sorts of political and cultural situations. And I wanted to speak to you about sort of, you know, where do we go with this, and how have you been thinking about it in the book, of course, but otherwise as well. How do we as anthropologists also look at marriage and sort of this dichotomy, this sort of strange duality between what may be love and arranged marriage?
Sure. Thank you. That's a great question. The first thing about how I started to rethink about marriage, or how do one can go about thinking about marriage, there's a lot of work has been done. There are great new works have come out, but also most of the works also still works within the sort of a certain, when it comes to South Asia at least, people think about marriage also in terms of honor, idea of duty, idea of, you know, rights, and so on, so forth, which are very important concept to deal with. But also, if you want to reassemble different ways to think about, so that's what I purposely put together, different kind of people that you don't normally think about in marriage. For example, marriage brokers are always at the margins of any marriage studies, for example, or kinship studies, or wedding photograph. Few people have worked on wedding photograph. Lovely works have come out, but also that is not a central to the idea of marriage, because if you think about how wedding photograph capturing certain rituals and event, or people think about different kind of documents produced in the marriage broker's offices, and what kind of detailed information that carries, or questions about how people even have wedding packages, for example, what that wedding packages tells about marriage and relationships, and how certain idea of romance and love are produced through these wedding packages in the wedding photographs. And sometimes these photographs are produced to prove, in my case, in the transnational marriages, in the proof to the visa office that the wedding is a real wedding. It's not a marriage of convenience. The genuine marriage. So sometimes, because the visa office is looking at the photographs and scrutinizing the photograph and saying that, oh, there is not enough intimacy between the couple. So suddenly the love and the romance are produced for somebody's gaze, right? So there is an idea about, so I'm putting together a different way to think about marriage rather than in a very classical way in which we think about marriage. So that tells us, already tells us something different about marriage. In that sense, in that spirit, when you asked about the question about arranged and love marriage, I think this is a debate that we have been having a long time, and I've been teaching a course on marriage, sex, love in South Asia for my class, 2000 level class here. And every time when I teach this course, the students, when I ask about, tell me about South Asian marriages, they'll immediately say it's an arranged marriage. Right, they complete immediately. So there is a sort of this stereotypical idea about South Asia is always full of arranged marriage. But my, even if you think the cross cousin marriage is the big thing, the big thing in South Asia, and the lot of works and kinship studies have been dealt with this idea of cross cousin marriage. But even if you think about cross cousin marriage, if you from the childhood you know that this person, you are going to marry this person when you grow up, right? Because this is your cross cousin, and there is a possibility that you're going to get married. And that also means that the person is going to develop a certain kind of romance and love towards the person, and intimacy towards that person. So even that is, seems to be like an arranged from the childhood, that this is the cross cousin marriage. This is what's going to happen in the future, or even there's a possibility of this cross-cousin marriage that will take place among the society. There is an idea of that you're going to marry this person in the future, makes them to create a certain kind of intimacy. So this idea of arrange and the love is already disturbed even within the cross-cousin marriage system for me. So that's one way to think about it. And the second one, in from my work, when I started the way in which these marriages are arranged in my book, when I was started looking at the idea of arranged marriages, of course, these marriages are arranged through marriage brokers or relatives or friends. But in this context, once they compare the charts, they compare the other factors, and then they say the two families sort of like the idea of their daughter or son getting married to the other person. Once that come to that level, they will exchange the phone numbers, right? So they will give the phone number of the bride to the groom or possible groom, or they will give the possible groom's number to the possible bride. And that will allow them to talk to each other over the phone, over Skype. And that might even take, 2 months, 3 months, so on and so forth. And interestingly, many of these people who talked to me, or even the brokers who talked to me, who told me that how they develop a certain kind of intimacy within that 3 months period, right? So even though it is arranged, the way in which that whole process takes place, there is an idea of romance and love also inbuilt into that. So there is an interesting way to think about this. There's no then at the end of at the start of the real marriage or at the start of the rituals and the ceremonies, you don't know whether this is actually real arranged or a love marriage, because it already blurred the line between the arranged and the love marriages. By the time they come to marriage, right? And the way in the wedding photographs are produced, for example, they produce with so much intimacy. And also, it's not only it is catered to a particular visa officers to make sure that this is a genuine marriage, but is also there's a lot of influence from Bollywood, and there's a lot of influence from Tollywood and Tamil Nadu muse, cinema, and so on and so forth. So there is a certain kind of romantic element that is built into this wedding photographs and videos and so on and so forth. So the whole point I was trying to say is to one, maybe have to break away from this very strict binary on which that we work for a long time, idea of love and arranged marriage in the South Asian context, but to rethink about how certain kind of intimacy are possible even within the so-called arranged marriages.
Thank you so much. That is extremely well put, and in a way I think is very generative to start thinking about the possibilities of romance and love without sort of having to decide whether it is arranged or not. You know, you did speak of how the lines between arranged marriage and love marriage is sort of, you know, a counterproductive exercise in some sense. And in a way, I wanted to also ask you to speak to you about the kinds of similarities, if we were to, for this, you know, let's say if we did stick to the misplaced stereotype of love marriage and arranged marriage, the kinds of reproduction of caste identities that you are trying to also tell our readers, the readers of your book, in a way, transnational marriages do not really disturb that too much either. In a way that arranged marriages, the whole idea of sort of this endogamous practice of arranged marriages in some senses also to conserve and reproduce those kinds of caste status and identities. So in that spirit, can you speak to our listeners about what does caste identity and status mean for both arranged and love marriages, if you stick to those stereotypes for a moment?
Sure. Caste identities. So it is true. Transnational marriages is not necessarily broken down the caste identities or sort of people moved away from endogamy marriages and so on and so forth. It's in a way it still reinforces caste identities, but I think there is a slight difference between Sri Lanka and India in if you take the caste identity, because caste identities or caste claims are not publicly made in Sri Lanka. It is unspoken. People actually practice it, of course, in a greater sense, but they don't speak them in public and they don't claim it in public because it has various reasons. We don't have a quota system, for example, for caste like India to get jobs or to be in parliament and so on and so forth. So in a way, it's not publicly acknowledged, the caste thing, but it very much operates. So there's a secrecy also. So people always trying to identify you, not asking who are you or which caste you are from, but they will ask you, where are you from? So you will say Jaffna. Then if you say Jaffna, they will then try to figure out which part of Jaffna. Then it will come to the particular Ur, which is a particular village. And then in the village, they will try to figure out which section of the village you are in. And from that, they will pick and then say, oh, you are from. They'll know. So it's always a conversation always take place. Even in a marriage negotiation that I was witnessing in the marriage broker's offices, it's always a conversation about where are you from, who are you, where do you live, and where's your bride's family lives, or the groom's family lives, and which part of the road in the particular village they live, and so on and so forth. And that conversation is all about trying to identify the caste. So even in this dispersed moment, and then people scattered and fragmented with the war and gone to many places, if you look at the marriage broker's office and the files they created, have detailed information about who married whom, not only with the bride and the groom, but the groom's brothers and sisters, and who they are married to, and where they are living now, and where their parents. So it'll sort of, you can trace them through that. But always, if you look at there's a caste column in the file. In that column, there is completely empty. So you will not know whether the person is from which caste by just reading that. But if you're reading the other people's information, you can trace them. So you have to trace them. And that's the way in which in Sri Lanka, especially in Jaffna, especially in the Jaffna Tamils, the caste operates. It's a very public secret. And also people use it. People use it in many ways and reinforce it, but it was never spoken openly. So in that sense, here again in the transnational marriages, it's reproduced. And also I've told in my work that is my in the introduction that it's my work is also about a particular caste group mostly, and it is always the so-called upper caste people, and it's always a middle class or the upper middle class people that I have worked with, because I enter through marriage brokers, and the marriage brokers always operate with upper caste group, but also they have files or brides and grooms files of other caste as well, so that there is also, but these are the majority clients they have, so that is one thing. So in that sense, still in that sense, it very much operates, the caste operates within the marriage broker's office, and the marriage brokers in a way recreate this sort of caste thing. But for me, the quite interesting ways in which the caste operates, because by recreating it, it's on the one hand, one can argue that it reinforces the caste identity through this sort of creating these files and details about peoples and who married. But on the other hand, it also creates a certain kind of familiarity for people who are dispersed. For people who have gone and imagine that everything is been completely scattered and everything become unknown. For them, this is suddenly the caste identity becoming something known thing for them. So suddenly for them, that familiarity creates the possibility of a certain kind of future. Right. So I'm not saying that caste is reinforced is a good thing, but I'm saying that I'm trying to think about how that familiarity suddenly been produced. But on reproducing of the familiarity also reproduce the caste identity.
That's amazing. You know, I had this question in mind when I was reading the book in a way that you have already sort of begun to address it in response to my previous question. And without sort of making any essentialist claim, I was trying to read the book in a larger context of not just political violence and uncertainty, but also, if one were to do that exercise, to place it in a larger understanding of personhood. And the way that you were speaking about, you know, recreating relationships, relatedness, kinship, and the idea of a family, even though everybody is sort of living outside the so-called family and creating new sort of locations and relationships constantly, which then goes a long way to inform what does it mean to be a Jaffna Tamil of a certain caste and class location. So I wanted to actually request you to offer a few comments on, is there a way in which it is possible to understand marriage and personhood together? And I say this with some amount of sort of suspicion, because increasingly, you know, the valence of marriage as an institution, if not a process, is something that, you know, all of us are questioning. So what is then the resonance of marriage and marriage rituals determined by the kind of sort of transnational alliances crucial to a certain kind of being a Jaffna Tamil in this case, but broadly in being a certain kind of person? I'm compelled to ask this question because of the way in which you very beautifully give us an ethnography of, you know, making someone trustworthy. The whole process of inquiry, which is, I suppose, if I'm pronouncing this correctly, visarita. So this is the whole idea of visarita, right? Making these inquiries, making by the process of contracting this marriage to various people and institutions and events, you make people real and trustworthy. So if you could, you know, in that sense, speak to what is this relationship between sort of marriage, personhood, and belonging in the context which you gave us. But if that is a possibility beyond your text as well.
Sure. That's a very interesting question. Very, very interesting question. So the idea of personhood and marriage, I think that's a big field, but in let me take it through my some of the examples that I have from the book. So the one idea about personhood also comes from, as you said, rituals, just to holding on to certain kind of rituals. And also one of the ways in which I think about rituals, actually not in Jaffna, not in Canada, but in India, for example, because both the brides and the grooms come to India to get married, because at that time, most of the people who have gone as refugees to Canada, Sri Lankan Tamils who have gone to refugees in Canada, they cannot return back because they didn't have proper documents, or they didn't become citizens to come back. And also war was taking place at that time, so they didn't want to come. So they will come closer to a place, to Sri Lanka, which is always the Tamil Nadu. India become the place for them to come, and the bride or the groom from Sri Lanka will travel. So they will all come in India, in Tamil Nadu, and then they'll get married. And interestingly, this is like a 14 days event, because they'll get about 2 weeks leave to come to do these things from Canada, because of the job and work and so on and so forth. And the bride's family and also families and relatives from all over the world will also come there. So suddenly in these 14 days, every different people from different part of the world come from who are relative or friends of brides and groom come to this place, and they will also buy a package, wedding packages, is mostly offered by the Sri Lankan refugees who are actually living in Tamil Nadu. There's a larger Sri Lankan refugees in Tamil Nadu who also arrange these wedding packages. And these wedding packages have a Sri Lankan priest, Sri Lankan photographer, Sri Lankan food, and so on and so forth, and a guest house to stay. So the people will come, stay in the guest house. So it's kind of a Sri Lankan sort of Sri Lankan village atmosphere is recreated through the idea of this ritual. So there's kind of authenticity, right? Idea of the Sri Lankan personhood, Sri Lankan sort of village, kinship, and the marriage has been created. So I was chasing this idea of wedding packages, and they want a specific ways in which the rituals has been done. And the Sri Lankan priest, that was my interesting point, that looking at why Sri Lankan priest. There are a lot of Indian priests from Tamil Nadu who has the same mantra, same rituals, right? But why they want Sri Lankan priest? And in our number, even I have showed in the book that in one case that the father of the bride was not very happy the way in which, because there was an Indian priest at that time, the Sri Lankan priest could not come, so they got an Indian priest, and they were not very happy the way in which they were doing thing. And the father could not explain to me exactly what was wrong, but he was saying, this is not the way we do it. This is not the way we do it. And when I talked to the Indian priest at that time, the priest says, no, I have done so many wedding rituals and everything. Why they are questioning my authority? And the wedding photographer, who was a Sri Lankan specialist, refugee at that time, and who was a wedding photographer, who was also questioning the ayah and saying that the priest, and saying that he is not doing it properly. It's doing wrong, and so on and so forth. So I was really puzzled by what is the big difference, but nobody could not give an answer. Even I talked to the Indian priest, he said, this is what I do it. And then next time when I met a Sri Lankan priest who was doing the same rituals, I was asking, what's the difference between the Indian priest who doing conducting the marriage ritual and the Sri Lankan priest? And he was trying to give few examples. Then at the end of the example, he said that, you should read this book. I follow this book, which is published by the Hindu ministry in Sri Lanka and written by this priest and so on and so forth. So I thought maybe I should trace back to this book, and I traced the priest, and I did. And I went and met the priest and asked him, can you tell me the differences? And you know what? He went to his within in his room and brought his own book and started reading from his own book. So in a funny way that so I asked him, you know everything by heart, why are you reading from your book? And he said that, no, I want to make sure that is correct. I'm saying exactly the way. So the idea that I was trying to trace, the idea of the authenticity, authentic Tamil Sri Lankan marriages or Jaffna Tamil marriages, at that point came to me, struck me that, there's nothing called authenticity. Is this the imagination that when the people come together as a wedding photographer, the community, the bride, the groom, the family, everybody come together. It is in that moment of imagination, what is the Sri Lankan Jaffna Tamils come sort of allows them to sort of gives a certain idea of the familiarity for them to think about togetherness, whereas something new comes into that that imagination, something like an Indian ayer, disturb that kind of familiarity. So the authenticity is based on this imagination, a collective imagination of a familiar rituals and ideas, rather than it is what is exactly the authenticity of that ritual is. So in that sense, the idea of the Jaffna Tamil personhood, for example, it not relies on the idea of this is the authentic idea of this personality, but this idea of it's very fragmented. But different fragments come together to create a certain kind of familiarity and imagine together a personhood or an idea of identity, which is not necessarily something that actually point to a direction of authentic identity, but it is very fragile and very fragmented, and it's very multiple, and it's constantly changing. But it's at that moment of collective togetherness and the collective imagination and collective coming together, moment of thinking is a way in which one can say in which that authenticity sort of emerges, but also it can disappear at the next moment. And same thing happens in Canada. If you look at the Canadian the weddings that take place in Toronto, for example, among the Sri Lankan Tamils, it's also you will see different kind of rituals take place, but sometimes people even don't know why they are doing it. But it's an idea of, you know, they're thinking that is the right way of doing it. And the right way is always very fragmented, I guess. So in a way, the short answer to the idea of the marriage and the personhood is to think about even the idea of the personhood not as one thing or a unit, but to think it as a sort of multiple fragments.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Absolutely. Absolutely. You couldn't have said it better. You know, I'll come to my favorite chapter of the book, which is the chapter on the wedding albums and the production and the photographers. It is such a stunning and unusual thing to come across in anthropological texts, where the visual language is not just a stamp to prove what the text is saying, but in a way that the visual resonance of these kinds of things becomes a part of the argument, and it is the argument in effect in this particular chapter about the production of the modern wedding album. And I have a couple of questions about that in that sense. One is, what are the kinds of, I see you have an interest in cinema more broadly, and perhaps in Tamil cinema, in Tollywood and in Bollywood more particularly. So what are the kinds of like influences other than obviously seeing the fact that wedding photographers among various other agents have become such crucial actors in witnessing the marriage and helping others witness the marriage, including paralegals and the immigration officers and the court officials and all of that set of people help, you know, witness the marriage even when they were not really part of the marriage. So what are the kinds of sort of, you know, broader aesthetic influences that made you sort of, that helped you identify this in the first place? Because this is something that we all can perhaps observe, but can also pass through our eyes as not being majorly crucial to how lossy is marriage. So that is one sort of question I had about the chapter. And the other question that I had was, you know, the book as a whole, and one of those chapters in particular, does a fantastic job of telling us once again the various ways in which law can influence everyday social ordinary life, and particularly something as ordinary as marriage, in this case actually quite extraordinary. And I wanted you to speak to us about the kinds of choices that you had to make in tracking the kinds of court cases and the material and visual evidence of what you call the intention to marry and how it had to be reproduced in these various occasions and how various actors come together to help that happen. So just to summarize, the two questions I have are one about the ways in which you were able to identify the aesthetics of the modern wedding album as crucial to a certain witnessing of the marriage, as well as the kinds of choices that you had to make in tracking these particular cases through, right from the happening of the marriage right to Canadian immigration tribunals and courts.
Okay, thank you. Wedding photos, true that we always overlook a lot of photos when we do our research, and I did too. I was not going with this idea of looking at the wedding photos at all. I was actually, it sort of emerged from the field, the wedding photographs, especially because when I was looking at the transnational marriages, a lot of people were talking at that time how they have to produce these photographs to the immigration officers, especially to Canadian immigration officers, to prove as one of the proofs. On top of other documents, they have to produce these photographs to show that these rituals have taken place, how many people have come to the wedding, and how many people have witnessed the wedding, and how it has taken place, and so on and so forth. So that is one point which I thought about, okay, maybe the wedding photographs, and I started collecting wedding photographs, and I was observing in the wedding rituals when I was involved in the wedding ceremonies. The role of the wedding photographer, who actually suddenly have more authority than the priest, because he could stop the rituals and say, I want to take a picture. So the priest also will sort of work towards that and sometimes repeat the rituals in a way that if it's not been captured first time. So that fascinates me, the suddenly the authority of the photograph that emerged in this ritual over the priest. So that's one, and how these photographs become very crucial for people to reunite across the borders. So these are two things drew me into this, and I thought, how do I think about it? But the more I start working with the photograph, the other interesting things start to emerge. It's not only about the aesthetic, the way in which it actually created. So it's not just only for the wedding photographer, but it's also create other forms of community through wedding photograph, because this wedding album is the only thing. Because imagine these communities are dispersed, right? So the different families are living in different places. You know, the typical Tamil diaspora, if you think about it, it's like have multiple homes. The parents might be living in Sri Lanka, the siblings might be living in different part of the world, in Australia, Canada, and the bride and groom living in Canada, for example. So, but the wedding photographs and the wedding videos also, which I didn't talk about in my book, but I also collected wedding videos, they are the one which circulates among these multiple homes. When they move among the multiple homes, they also, people come and watch together. And they talk about it. They see people again. This is because this is a moment in which everybody come together from different part of the world. So this produces a certain kind of moment for people to see each other, but also been recorded and witnessed that moment. And also that moment is circulating among different homes. And where people come together and watch and then comment and they talk about the wedding, talk about everything. So it recreate this kind of idea of community, idea of togetherness and so on and so forth. But also it has a lot of influence with the Tamil cinema. So the way in which the certain photographs have been done, the aesthetic comes from very Bollywood, Tollywood cinema background, but also very sophisticated wedding albums and so on and so forth. But interesting, what else also it happens in the process, people also cut and paste of people who could not come or who have died during the war into these pictures. And interestingly, in a normal process, always the dead are kept aside during the time of marriage, right? It's not auspicious to evoke the dead. But the dead are sort of kept aside. But in this, the dead have been brought in and through the wedding photographs. In that sense, the relationships are rebuilt between the living and the dead. And the photographs allow them to do that. And the ideal family is created. And when I ask them why you want to bring people who have died into the photograph and cut and paste them into the photograph, and a lot of people said that they would have lived if the war wasn't there. So the war destroyed, and they are rebuilding it in the photos. So the photos suddenly become something else also. And also when after the wedding in India, the father and the mother was leaving because the children who came for the wedding got married and left back to Canada, and their daughter-in-law has gone back to Sri Lanka, and they were leaving. So I was helping them packing the bags. The father was taking the photo album that was produced for the thing and said that this is the only thing that I have now. And he's taking and walking with him. And that shows that, you know, photographs are doing more than what it's supposed to do. It is also becoming a living thing for the father. His memories is for his son's future, his son's life, and daughters-in-law life, and his other relatives come together, whom he might not even see after this. Now all captured in this wedding, and that is the only thing that is in his hand, that he's carrying and going to live with. Right. So in that sense, for me, the photograph suddenly become many. It has many meanings. One is sort of aesthetic meaning. Other one is the meaning of producing as a witness, becoming a witness and becoming a living thing for the visa officers to scrutinize. But on the other hand, for the community, it also is able to rebuild life between the dead and the living, and it create an ideal family, even or for a father who might not even see the son. This become the thing that to live with him forever. Yeah. So that is the first question, I think, that's about what you were talking about, the photographs. And the second question that you talk about, intentionality of marriage and how the immigration officers. So once the whole process has started, because when the visa officers refuses the visa, spousal visa, on the basis of that it's not a genuine marriage, you can challenge that by taking it to the immigration courts in Canada. And then the immigration courts sort of look at the whole evidence and rework everything and to see whether this is a genuine marriage or not. And quite interestingly, most of the cases were rejected by the visa officers, actually be granted visas during the court sessions. So it's quite interesting how things happens. But I was interested, but how do they measure this is a genuine marriage or not? So the idea of measuring a genuine marriage is something based on the idea of intentionality of the couples. So what is the intention behind this marriage? Whether they want to stay together, there is an intention of creating a family, stay together, or is the intention is to coming to Canada? That was the whole thing. But how do you legally measure something called intention of these two couples, the intentionality of the couples? Which is very interior thing, right? When you think about intentionality, something interior. So how something is in an interior can be measured legally. So for me, then the interior has to be performed through some sort of exterior things, right? So it has to perform outside the person, through which the people can measure the real intentionality. And the measuring happens through ways in which how do they know about each other's? What kind of information they have about each other's? And whether they are sending money to each other? Are they writing letters? Are they keep on touch? Are they talking to each other? So what is the real intention? So this intentionality is being measured through different kind of performance that takes place between the couples. And that intentionality creates kind of, this is the real intention for them to come to Canada, is to start the family. And interestingly, for me, the intentionality measured through many forms. They're not only produced through Civil Marriage Act document that they have to produce, but also about they have to produce all kind of things about WhatsApp messages, Skype messages, or other kind of documents. If they have transferred money from one account to other account, how long they have been doing that, and so on and so forth. So this kind of a commitment to each other's and each other's life. But this is sort of legally measured, the idea of intentionality. And when I was tracing that, and I've quite interestingly found that this idea of intentionality is something not as new to the immigration process, but also took place in the colonial times. I went back to the Sri Lankan marriages in Sri Lanka. And during the colonial time, when the British introduced the Civil Marriage Act and trying to make everybody to adhere to the Civil Marriage Act, a lot of people didn't compel. So the Civil Marriage Act was not in full force. So at that time, and especially the registration was not in full force. So the colonial authorities also accepted the customary marriage practices. But the question, when the customary marriage come to a question, there's a dispute over customary marriage, then there were a lot of court cases that talked about how the colonial officers and judges actually worked with the idea of customary marriages. And when I traces that court cases, I found out that there were a lot of discussion about whether this is a proper marriage or not, this is a proper customary marriage or not. In that, they were trying to figure out whether this has happened according to this particular caste custom or not. So this customary marriages have been also redefined in this court spaces by the colonial authorities. But also interestingly, the idea of intentionality also been evoked in that marriages. And the intentionality of a person also emerged through idea of what kind of rituals they have performed and how these rituals are performed according to different castes. So even this has been broken down into different castes, but the intentionality is worked out idea of what exact rituals has performed, whether this ritual has performed, therefore there is an intention, real intention. If there's no ritual performed, there is a lack of intention, because the idea behind the judge is the ritual is essential for people for the future life. So if they're not performing that ritual, they're not very much keen about the future. So there is the idea, even though I sort of compare two different court spaces, the immigration court space and the colonial court spaces, for me, the way in which they both connected through the idea of intentionality, how the legal languages come to measure something called intentionality, both in the colonial and the post-colonial times. And it continued to redefine marriages and redefine relatedness or make or unmake relatedness through the legal languages of intentionality or by measuring the idea of intentionality.
That is so useful. Your response is so useful to someone like me who has read the book, but to put in perspective the kinds of afterlives that law can have, right from being a colonial sort of exercise to the contemporary global regime of immigration. So thank you for, sort of restating that. Thank you so much, Siddharthan. This has been such an enjoyable conversation. I have really, really learned so much in the way of the reading the book, but also talking to you today. And I know we have taken up a lot of your time. But before I let you go, I really also want you to tell us what you're doing next and what can we hope to see from you next in the form of an essay or book. What's the next thing that's keeping you occupied?
Okay. One project I think I am almost over, but the publications are coming that I can talk about is I got interested in religion and politics. So it's a big shift from marriage to religion and politics. But again, it's also along with the idea of diaspora. So I'm still interested in the idea of diaspora and how things works. And I always worked between Sri Lanka and the Tamil diaspora. So it's a comparative study. So this is also to think about religion and Hindu politics Hindu temples in the diaspora and in Sri Lanka. This actually emerged from a very interesting puzzle. Puzzle is that in Sri Lanka, the Hindu temples able to withstand, even in the height of the conflict and the war, the Hindu temple able to withstand Tamil nationalistic politics and had its own life without mingling with the Tamil nationalist politics. But while in the Tamil diaspora, the Hindu temples somehow mingling with the Tamil nationalist politics and also become a certain kind of, certain temples have become at least in the, during the time of war, has become a place of sort of a pro-Tamil nationalist places. So my question is how one, the religious space in one place able to withstand politics has become a part of a politics in the other space. So that's a larger question. And I try to answer this by looking at, I was quite interested in the idea of deities. And how looking at the deities in the temples and to think about the idea of sovereign deities and how the sovereign deities in these temples able to withstand cannot withstand the Tamil national politics. So in a larger sense, I was trying to work the idea with, rather than thinking about politics versus religion, I was trying to work through the idea of sovereignty, which is sort of a cut across this idea of politics and religion through sort of a interesting idea of political theology. So in a way, can we rethink about sovereignty, idea of notions of sovereignty through a very polytheistic religious perspective or multiple ideas of powers rather than the centralized idea of or Judeo-Christian idea of sovereignty, which is centered around a very monotheistic religious concept and everything. So that was my preoccupation for the last 3-4 years, I suppose. And I'm trying to work on, and I think there's the article coming out in Current Anthropology soon on that. So that's sort of, that's the one. And the last is that I'm thinking in the future. It's about actually to think about anthropology of futures. This is also a comparative research studies which I'm quite interested to think about whether how anthropologists can really think about. There are a few studies that have come out, of course, recently, but I'm also interested to think about how anthropologists can answer to this sort of what I call it a future turn, right? It's all about this idea about the futures, about big data, digital environment, Anthropocene. Everything is all about the idea of the futures. So how anthropologists can do this sort of answer to, and how anthropologists can really concretely study something called future or futures. And that need a bigger, I think, team and people who work on environment, and anthropology who work on urban studies, who work on borders, who work on STS and so on and so forth, right? So you need a team of people to think about collectively how to think about anthropology of futures. So that would be something that I'm quite interested in and want to develop further at some point of my life, I guess.
Wow, they both sound like such great projects, and I am for one looking to the future, for the futures of this project. So I want to thank you once again, Siddharthan, so much for being on the show today. I really enjoyed it, and I hope our listeners will as well. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Bhumika. It was a great conversation. I really enjoyed it. I really thank the New Books Network as well for giving me this opportunity to share some of my thoughts and also about my book. Thank you so much.
All right then, Siddharthan. Bye.
Bye.